This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
I want to see the Seahawks use each and every single draft pick they have to get the fastest defensive players possible. I'm slightly exaggerating, but only slightly. But maybe there's another way to overcome a lack of defensive talent. Paul, you think that maybe the offense changes up the way it plays and creates an advantage that's more suitable to your defense?
I mean, I've been thinking about this more and more. Your strength is your offense. If you make your strength stronger, you could maybe mask some of the weaknesses of the defense. And if you really think about it over the course of this past season, with all the leads that the Seahawks were trying to dig themselves out of, how many times was that defense of theirs very limited, put in a situation where they had control over the situation? And by that I mean, how many times were the Seahawks able to send their defensive line out there and say, all right, guys, just run straight upfield. Just do your thing, get to the quarterback, get after him. They have an offense that should lend itself to having leads, having a multiple score lead, and making it so that a team turns one-dimensional on the other side of things. And I hate to go into like this complimentary football-splaining thing that Bill O'Brien used to do with me, but I feel that the offense could actually make the defense's life a lot easier by just taking them out of spots where they don't know if it's going to be a run or a pass.
I can see that and the idea that, hey, that does... I just don't think that's the way the Seahawks play. It doesn't mean that's the way they have to play, that they could change to that style. Here's how I see Seattle's defense. Seattle's defense, almost by design, is built to take punches. Pete Carroll will talk about the rope-a-dope, and I don't think it's entirely some sort of funny joke. I don't think he's serious that, hey, we're going to let the opponent punch itself out. They're going to get tired hitting our face. But there is an element of they don't blitz. The priority of their cornerbacks is, hey, we want you to bump and run, but you can't get beat deep. They're measuring everything in explosive plays. Like, that's the biggest criticism of a defense that Pete will have is when they give up too many explosive plays. And Pete's belief is, let's make the other guy have as many successful plays as possible. Let's not give them anything quick, and eventually they're going to make a mistake first. We're going to be the ones that outlast them. What does he tell us? The goal is to do right longer. That's essentially a template of, hey, we're gonna outlast them and we're gonna be able to take more punches. It is the Rocky defense. I do like the idea though, and have seen it before, where if you get a good offense, it sets up your defense, and whether you want to say it masks weaknesses, if you're playing from in front, your defense is going to end up looking a lot better because the opponent is more forced to pass. They're doing something you know they're gonna do.
Right, and look, Kansas City doesn't do it this way. Kansas City, especially in the playoffs, I mean, they had a multiple score deficit in every single one of the games that they played in. But optimally, Kansas City probably thinks to itself, we're going to get a two-score lead on you, and good luck. We're just going to send people at you. We're going to make it difficult for you to get those big plays. The strategy that you just laid out, Danny, it makes perfect sense because you do want to make it so that there are as many times as a offense could possibly have to screw up. And you hope that it happens when the field shrinks in the red zone and that you can maybe get an interception or a sack and a fumble recovery in that spot. But over the course of a game, with an offense that does have the big play capability that it does, and with an offense that also is very good, I think, at controlling the clock because they like to have that kind of balanced style, I think on defense, too, you could change things up from a perspective of, hey, let's blitz more. If you got some fast players out there and your pass rush isn't doing anything, doesn't it make zero sense to just say, all right, well, you know, that's just what the pass rush is. Here are four guys running upfield and not having guys come off the edge. I mean, the best moment, perhaps, of the playoffs defensively for the Seahawks defense was when the brothers Griffin met in an embrace with little Aaron Rodgers and they brought him down together. You didn't see a whole lot of that during the playoffs.
No, they typically, and just as a rule, this defense doesn't blitz all that much. Is this a matter, can they do that with personnel? Can they improve their offense by adding personnel, or do you need a wholesale philosophical change? Because, and this gets back to kind of one of the underlying questions throughout this offseason, is do you need a schematic adjustment? And I think it goes for both sides of the ball.
And you mean like improve the fair defense, right? You said improve the offense.
Yeah,
improve the defense.
No, improve the offense.
Okay,
can you do that by just adding personnel, or do you need a schematic adjustment? Do you, can you become an offense that plays complementary football, that builds a lead to help your defense by just adding a few more playmakers? Or does it take an actual philosophical adjustment in the way games are called? Because I actually think that they have the talent. They're closer to having the talent to do that on offense than they are to playing the way they want in defense. I think the speed is there with Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. I think they've got the running backs. I think it's a mindset as much as it is personnel to get to a place where the offense can take the lead and can put the defense in a better situation.
Definitely. And you've been covering this for a long time. The mindset, and I remember I've had it explained to me, hawksplained, if you will, a couple of times. Well, you don't win in the first quarter. You don't win in the second quarter. You don't win in the third quarter. You win in the fourth quarter or in overtime if you make it to overtime. And I don't know. I think you can win in the first quarter. I think you can win in the second quarter. I think you can build a lead that is such with maybe better players on offense or just a more aggressive style on offense that also could lend itself to a more aggressive style defensively. And I get it. It has worked for a long period of time. But after a certain point, I think you have to look at who you have and how difficult it might be to fix a lot of the holes that you have, specifically defense. I mean, you just laid it out at the start of the show. We're looking at a defense that where someone, if they were to come up to you and say, yeah, I want the defense to be the entire focus of the draft. I want all the picks to go to the defense. Are you really going to say, well, that's just stupid. That doesn't make any sense. No, the defense could use as many swings as possible to bring in guys that can rush the passer, to bring in guys that can maybe help out in coverage. So I do think that a little bit more aggression on offense and perhaps, I don't know, adding a little bit of a vertical element to the offense, say, a la Kansas City, I think that could help out a lot. And I think that defensively, too, on top of that, I think that would help out because then they could play a style where they are not thinking about what's next. Is it going to be a run? Is it going to be a pass? Let's just run straight upfield and make it easy for ourselves.
There's no doubt that that is a huge advantage. And we've seen it here in Seattle. 2005, they had a great offense, and it was a very mediocre defense that statistically looked great. Why? Because that offense gave them leads, and that offense controlled the ball, and that offense put the opponent in a corner where you're really limited. And when you can know that, hey, two-thirds of the plays from here on out are going to be passes, puts the defense in a huge advantage.
Exactly. I'll point out the Indianapolis Colts. I'm a big Dwight Freeney fan. He went to Syracuse. Shout out to my alma mater, which apparently did not land Michael Vick. I learned that in the Michael Vick documentary. Very crushing. Anyway, Dwight Freeney and Robert Mathis, two great pass rushers. Do they have the pass rushing careers that they do if they're not in Indianapolis?
Absolutely not. They're made, but because so many opponents, they're undersized, fast edge rushers.
Right.
They're a liability against the run.
Yep.
And both of them were able to make careers, multi-million dollar careers, and be great players. In Freeney's case, I mean, he's a borderline Hall of Fame candidate when he comes up because they were able to rush the passer almost exclusively.
Right. And he's not much taller than me. He's got that amazing inside spin move, and I'm sure he could have had a successful career elsewhere, and he was pretty good after his time in Indianapolis too. But at the same time, those guys made the most of their situation because they were in a situation where the offense was just helping that defense out. It was a lot easier for that Indianapolis defense, which was never that good, had that really great stretch where they carried Peyton Manning to his first Super Bowl championship. They carried him to that championship.
I appreciate your acknowledgement of your alma mater, but I'm wondering if you can answer me a question about Syracuse University.
Oh.
Is it University of Syracuse?
Syracuse University.
Syracuse University's proud football program. Has there ever been a university that has produced more top-tier NFL talent while winning less?
Isn't it crazy?
It's nuts.
It's nuts.
Marvin Harrison.
Mm-hmm. Old handgun.
Dwight
yeah.
Freeney.
Mm-hmm.
Donovan McNabb.
Mm-hmm.
There's a linebacker. Is it Keith Bullock?
Yeah, I think it was Keith Bullock. Donovan Darius.
Jim Brown, if you want to go back a ways.
Floyd Little, Ernie Davis, Larry Zonka. You could go on and on. They've had tons of talent. Who is that tight end? John Mackey? Like, yes, there's tons of talent that has gone through Syracuse University. They should have won the national title in 1987, at least. I have no idea. I wasn't alive then. Yeah, they've had a lot of talent and it hasn't worked out, Danny.
No, it's the most, you can make an argument, like the biggest underachievers in college football history yeah. are at Syracuse University.
We're like LSU with Odell Beckham Jr. and Jarvis Landry and Zach Mettenberger and all those other professionals that they had.
Yeah. Yeah, it is Danny and Gallant. It's going to be a great show today, although I am a little bit concerned. I came in and logged onto the computer, and somebody had the tab on here open. Maybe it was in anticipation of me being here. It was something like, 10 signs you have a serious drinking problem? What the hell?
Who sits there? That's Bob's seat.
It's certainly not Bob. Bob's not the one that has to do that, but I looked at that, and I was like, oh, maybe they were anticipating me, or maybe somebody else is dealing with some stuff. Don't want to out anybody. It is Danny and Gallant. It's time to tell you what to watch for.
What to watch for every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dublin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
The Red Sox traded Mookie Betts. The Red Sox are cheap.
Yep.
They are cheap. They are. Mookie Betts is not yet a free agent. Like, he's just going to get a one-year contract at a huge number from arbitration. But they've decided to trade him so they can get rid of David Price. Because God knows you want to be able to pay Nathan Olive Oil or Eovaldi or whatever the hell his name is. Like, and pay him and Chris Sale. Like, yeah, let's get David Price out of here at the cost of Mookie Betts.
Nathan Eovaldi. I don't understand it at all. And then I think about it, and you remember, it's the Boston Red Sox, who, despite being one of the richest organizations in sports, an organization that I honestly think, whenever they say that they are trying to get under the luxury tax, they look bad. The Yankees, the Dodgers, and the Red Sox don't play the same game that everybody else in baseball does. And here they are, for the second time in less than a decade, basically shedding salary because they've spent too much on it. And the sad thing is, Mookie Betts is one of the best players in baseball.
He's great. Great right fielder.
Five-tool player. Here's the sad thing, because this is phase one. Phase one, when the Red Sox get rid of a guy that's really good, okay, everyone's saying, whoa, what's going on here? Phase two, article in the Boston Globe talking about all the things that Mookie Betts was not doing as a member of the Boston Red Sox. They were a petty organization.
I think that's a fairly reliable thing. They're getting back a prospect, Betts Price going to the Dodgers, and the Dodgers are sending somebody, Kent Maeda is going to the Twins. Kenta Maeda is going to the Minnesota Twins to complete that transaction. And Jock Peterson, he's going across town. He's going to the Angels. I wish he was coming up here, though I'm suspicious of that outfielder because he does not wear an undershirt.
A lot of chafing.
What to watch for.
Michigan State head coach Mark D'Antonio stepped down. That's two major college football coaches to leave their programs after successful stints, though it's a little bit different than the case of Chris Peterson because it seems that he's being forced out due to some very shady recruiting practices.
Well, he's also got a sexual assault investigation that's going on at his program right now. And
right.
He was asked what bearing that had on it. And here was Mark D'Antonio.
Mark, what factor, if any, was the lawsuit and the deposition and potential fallout from that?
Zero. No relevance whatsoever.
Okay.
Follow-up question, Mark. How much did having a contingent in your contract for just getting $4.3 million in cash if you remained in your job up to January 15th, how much of that was a factor in resigning now as opposed to a couple of weeks ago?
Well, I'm not going
to
begrudge him cashing in that extra money. Here's the – he is one of them. We're going to see increasing. There is no person on a college campus who acts with the level of entitlement that an old school football coach does, like where they believe they essentially own the place. And he is very much, that is his little kingdom that he rules. And we're going to see more and more guys as they step out, and it's going to be this, yeah, nobody forced me out. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Mm-hmm.
What to watch for.
Third element, KJ Costello. He was entertained the University of Washington here. Now it looks like he's going to choose Mike Leach at Mississippi State.
That is really interesting. I bet Jimmy Lake is really ticked off right now. Because Jimmy Lake, doesn't he have some animosity towards Mike Leach?
He just sticks it to Leach anytime they win.
He has animosity towards people liking Washington State. That's what it is.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
It seems like it might be specifically at Leach. I'll be interested to see what his
attitude is. He doesn't like
is.
People in his turf. This is just my conjecture. I don't think he likes people in Seattle gravitating towards Washington State, which particularly happened during the Gardner Minshew era when he felt like he could pick apart that offense, and he subsequently did.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how it changes because that's very possible. I think it's also possible that Leach has rubbed him the wrong way or one of his friends the wrong way in many of the staff turnovers, and it was something that was very personal because he would go out of his way to say that they ran the same five plays. Like, he really did stick it, which I didn't mind. Jim hates it, which I am endlessly entertained by.
Maybe KJ Costello wants the same five plays. So what are your dogs going to do about quarterback right
well,
now?
Well, hopefully we got somebody on campus, whether it's Dylan Morris or it's the Sermon kid that's going to be able to run around before the Chosen One gets there.
The Chosen One
the
is?
The Chosen Heward, Sam Heward, the
Slinging.
Lethal left-hander.
Slinging Sammy.
Slinging Sammy. It's time to bring in the professor. John Clayton is with us every single morning on our morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, what's going on?
Hey, just glad to be back home.
Yeah, we're glad you're back home as well. The Jags are going to play two games in London. I think your attitude about London games is about the same as mine is, which is like, meh, don't really care. This seems certainly like another step toward putting the Jaguars over there, though.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they're trying to think that they're going to get the 17-game schedule because that was going to be inevitable because, you know, if they're going to have a 17-game schedule, there's going to be 16 international games, and that number would go from 1 to 2. But I think this is a bad thing for both the Jacksonville fans and the Jacksonville players because I don't think the players are going to be all enamored about staying in London for 2 weeks. I don't think that seems to be good. I think you got the time difference that's not going to be good. And so I don't think this is a very positive thing. I know from the economic standpoint for the Jaguars, they get twice the money by playing over in London than they do in Jacksonville. And when you see that equation, you kind of get the feeling at some point they might make that full move.
But, John, it's Jacksonville.
Yeah.
You want to live in Jacksonville over London? Come on.
Yes.
Why? It's Florabama.
No, it's America.
It's America.
It's
America.
Yeah, it
it's
is.
Really America.
Well,
I mean,
you don't want to have that nine-hour time difference.
I agree with John here, and I think there's going to be a major issue. If I was the NFLPA, I would be raising my hand and saying you're going to need to offer us a huge subsidy. To tell that size of your workforce, essentially, you have to go live in Europe, I think is a tough sell. I think there's going to be a lot of guys that will look at it and say, like, I don't want that. I'm not, I can't go to college for on our bye week to go see my own college. Like, the transportation is going to be huge. I still think this is NFL owners, John, obsessing over the money that they've seen the European soccer clubs draw by expanding and becoming and getting fans in America, and they think we should be able to do that in Europe. Do we know there's an appetite for American football in Europe?
There is some. I don't know how much, but you're right about they're looking at the sponsorship dollars that go to soccer and hoping to at least, you know, get that coming into the NFL. There's no question that there's interest. They sell out the game. There seems to be a good response, but I can't judge right now, you know, how the overseas attitude is as far as overall interest. It's good enough to make a game work or five games work, but I don't know about when you're talking about an entire team.
John, I want your interpretation on this somewhat cryptic Instagram post by none other than Tom Brady, who put on his Instagram story yesterday, back at the TB12 sports complex to get to work. I'm not wearing a blazer to the Super Bowl next year. Sounds like he's very confident he'll be back in the Super Bowl this coming season. Where do you think that's going to be?
Probably New England. Because I think when you saw the commercial, the Hulu commercial, that kind of tipped off now that he's got a better feeling, which he didn't have maybe for a couple of weeks about the Patriots taking care of him. Because they have to take care of him in a couple of ways. One, pay him. And, of course, when the story came out Sunday that they're willing to pay him $30 million, that at least $30 million, that seems to be positive. The second part of it is, and he said he's been talking to the Patriots, is that they've got to get him better players so he can get back to the Super Bowl. So, no, I think this is another cryptic idea that where it was maybe as much as 60-70% that he's going to leave. Now I think it's probably about, you know, 80-85% that he's going to stay.
Greg Olson visiting the Seattle Seahawks. He's also going to visit, is it Washington and Buffalo, I think, were the other
yes.
two teams.
Mm-hmm.
He also made it clear yesterday that, hey, he didn't ask out of Carolina, that they decided they weren't going to pay him. I think he was owed $11.6 million next season. in his career, do you think he's going to be looking for a one-year opportunity and a chance to contend, or do you think he's looking for a multi-year deal?
No, I think he's looking for a one-year opportunity. I mean, maybe for cap reasons, it might be two or so, but I think he's taking it year by year right now. Then he had the, I guess, the sad news that his seven-year-old son had open-heart surgery just in the last week.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's like you know, he's a good man, a good person, but I think he's also smart. I mean, he realized that networks are after him. I think that Fox probably would have the lead on that, but it looks like he does want to squeeze in one more year of football.
Do you think Seattle would be a good fit for him?
Yes, I do, because, again, I think he wants to be on a team that maybe can get him to the Super Bowl. And you look at Washington, they're where are they? I mean, they're at the kind of the beginning stages right now. They're one of the second worst team in football last year. And it's not like they're going to make a rise like the San Francisco 49ers, particularly with Dwayne Haskins at quarterback. You know, Buffalo could be a good fit because it's a team, but it's still in the division with New England. And if Brady's back, you know, then you're maybe looking at a wild card. Here, he and some pass rush can be maybe the difference of getting this team into the Super Bowl or at least winning a division, which puts them in a position to do it. So I think they do have a chance on this one.
You mentioned the pass rush. How long do you think it'll be until we hear something concrete on Jadeveon Clowney's future?
March 16th or so, or maybe 17th, somewhere like that.
Okay. You know, start of the free agency window then.
Yeah, right before the start of the free agency window. You know, 18th of March is when it starts, so I'd say somewhere around there.
Yeah, we were talking about that yesterday, and Jess was asking. And my thought, John, you can tell me if you agree, was that because Clowney knows he won't be franchise tagged, the possibility of him agreeing to something with Seattle before he gets to the open market is really small, because for him, he looks at it and says, I might be the most desirable free agent on the market. I should at least see what I'm going to get, even if he has a pretty good idea. And just because he gets to free agency won't mean he's leaving, but he's almost certain going to at least engage the market.
Sure, because, again, I think Yannick down in Jacksonville is going to end up getting franchised. He may not like it. He may hold out like Clowney did, but I can't imagine Jacksonville giving him up. And I don't know, Yannick may not want to go to London either. But, you know, that's going to be out there. And so, I mean, you look at it, I mean, the guys that are going to get paid the most are probably going to be the quarterbacks. But when you talk about maybe among the top defensive positions, I mean, he's probably it. And so, you know, why it would be to his benefit to wait and see what the offers are, but then, you know, keep in touch closely with Seattle so that, you know, this might be the team he wants to be with the most.
How tricky is that process? Because without that franchise tag safety net, the Seahawks basically are going to be twiddling their thumbs during that free agency negotiation window. And all of a sudden, there could be some team that's a competitive team, which is where Clowney wants to play for, that comes out of nowhere with an offer that's ridiculous.
Yeah, very much so. That's what we saw happen with C.J. Mosley, and that caused a ripple effect to Seattle. Mosley gets, you know, $17 million to go to the New York Jets when the market was basically 15, and that forced the Seahawks to jump up and pay 18 for Bobby Wagner. So, yeah, that's when free agency, anything goes.
That said, Seattle's been pretty good at playing defense on free agents that they want. Red Bryant is a guy that I know the Patriots were interested in him, and Seattle ended up going up as high as New England would go to retain him. Michael Bennett he got an offer from the Chicago Bears that was higher than what the Seahawks had talked, and the Seahawks came up and matched it. So I expect them to be pretty aggressive in trying to retain Clowney, don't you, John?
Oh, sure, and I think you know where his heart is. I mean, you saw it back from November when he flew to Philadelphia, found out that he needed core surgery, and he didn't do it. He stayed with his teammates and tried to play through the pain and the agony and all that stuff. So, no, I think that, and he likes this group. He knows this is a team that maybe if he stays and they can add another pass rush or two, they can start really thinking Super Bowl. I mean, hey, as bad as things were with the pass rush this year, they had the two home games. If they had some running backs and some health on offense, they might have been able to win and almost won the San Francisco game.
Why did the coach of a 5-11 team in Anthony Lynn get a contract extension?
He was 12 wins the year before. I mean, he was 12-4 back, and they like him. And so he was going ahead into the last year of his contract, and so they go ahead and, you know, they give him the extension, and, you know, he's one of four minority coaches in football, and so I think that's great. I mean, because, again, I mean, you see with the Rooney Rule and how bad it is right now that you want more minority coaches, and here's one that was good enough and is liked enough by ownership that he was 12-4 back a year ago.
Professor, we always appreciate your time, and we're glad that your back boots on the ground here.
Yes. Well,
can we catch up with you tomorrow in the
morning
drive?
That sounds good.
Talk to you then. It is John Clayton taking a look ahead It's always fun to catch up with the professor, figure out exactly what's going on. Paul has the perfect idea for the Seahawks this offseason. Two birds, one stone, or is it two birds, one receiver? Something like that. We're going to figure out his plans for improving yourself while worsening your opponent next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
I confuse sayings a lot, and I kind of want to say, kill two cats with one stone, but that would involve killing cats, which would be very tragic.
It's awful.
It's really
Nobody's
sad.
Ever said that.
Right. No one's ever said
you
it.
You could kill two birds with one cat.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a cat would probably kill many, many birds if it actually was given the opportunity. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to kill many birds with one cat, Danny O'Neill. The San Francisco 49ers are in a very difficult situation right now. They're only going to have 13.9 million cap space this offseason. That's 26th in overall cap space. And they've got a lot of big-time contracts that they have to consider coming up. This offseason, Eric Armstead and Jimmy Ward are guys that they have to think about, as well as Emmanuel Sanders, a wide receiver that they traded for at the trade deadline. I think the Seahawks should sign Emmanuel Sanders. I mean, if they add another vertical guy that can run straight down the field, give you some elements of slot receiver ability too, now you have three guys that can stretch the field for Russell Wilson. And what's Russell Wilson best at? The deep ball. If you were to add another element like that, I think you're going to be in a really good situation. You don't have to draft anybody. You're bringing in speed. You probably have to pay a little bit more than you would like to, but it's not like you're going to be paying a lot for a veteran wide receiver that was traded at the trade deadline. This is a guy that I think would be a perfect addition to this offense.
Here's, I want to get on board.
You want
to? I'm trying to overcome my bias against signing free agent wide receivers. I tend to, and maybe this is just a product of the number of times it has not worked out here. Deion Branch, TJ Houshmandzadeh, Sidney Rice. Let's see. I don't really want to throw Jerron Brown in there because they didn't pay him that much money, but he didn't knock anybody's socks off or blow anyone away. I look at it and I'm like, it sounds good in theory, but that's kind of like communism and backup quarterbacks. Like, it looks better in the idea stage than it actually does when it gets executed. And he's 32. I'm not against it, though. I do see the value, and I don't know who slides into. They really could use someone who is really good and precise in his route running. Someone that is able to kind of fill that niche that Doug Baldwin, wasn't a niche for Baldwin. I mean, he was an entree in the offense, but someone who can be that third down safety blanket.
He's been successful in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of receivers have been successful in Pittsburgh, and it honestly goes to their coaching staff, all the guys that they have been able to turn into plus talents, whether it's Mike Wallace or Antonio Brown and many, many others, Juju Smith-Schuster, the latest of which. He was successful in Denver despite a variety of bad quarterback situations towards the end. And then on top of that, you take a look at him, and with the San Francisco 49ers, despite being traded midway through the year, he was really effective. And Jimmy Garoppolo and he got along great going from there. But I understand your reservations about signing a free agent wide receiver. I also think that you really get to stick it to the San Francisco 49ers here, not just because of the cap space thing. If you listen to Emmanuel Sanders after the Super Bowl, does this sound like a guy who is happy playing with Jimmy Garoppolo, who may or may not have overthrown him on a possible
game? Oh, definitely overthrown. I mean, look, that was, and Brock talked about it yesterday. Look, that was something they've been setting up. That was something they were looking for. Where they're at, right near midfield, they get the bracket coverage they want, and the pass goes 5 yards over his head.
What do you think it was? What route do you think it was? What did it look like? What did it look like? What route do you think it looked like? Yeah. What did you see? How close was I to grab it? Yeah. How close do you think I was to grab it? It's a dumb question. Next question.
I don't blame Emmanuel Sanders for handling that situation the way that he does. I think we very often jump down these players' throats when they're forced to sit at a podium after losing the biggest game of their life that they might never, ever get to go back to. They have to sit there and basically reflect on what happened while people are saying, hey, what happened on that pass? Hey, you didn't catch it. What was going on there? But I think that if you're Emmanuel Sanders, even if you had some success with Jimmy Garoppolo this past season, and you're presented with the idea, because the 49ers aren't going to franchise tag him.
No.
You're on the open market. You have the ability to play with all sorts of different wide receivers. Don't you want to play for someone who is a lot more similar to, I don't know, how about Peyton Manning when he was actually taking the world by storm offensively, or like Ben Roethlisberger, than Jimmy Garoppolo or any of the quarterbacks that he was working with towards the end of his days in Denver?
It would be an interesting decision that I think we'll learn a lot by what players want to go and play in Kyle Shanahan's offense. I have a lot. I think Kyle Shanahan does some pretty remarkable things. With Sanders, he was available at the trade deadline. And the 49ers at that point valued him more than the Seahawks did. By definition, right? They got the deal. If they had offered more to Denver, Seattle would have been able to get him. I wonder now, would Seattle now value him more than San Francisco does? Because I would think the way he played, he had a way bigger impact with the 49ers than I expected him to.
Right.
Like, coming in midseason, like they obviously... So that idea of value and how it works in the NFL, but if Sanders decides he doesn't want to play in that offense, it seems like that's going to be a place that guys want to play, though, right? And isn't it a hard sell to get a guy to come to this offense if he's a receiver? Like, hey, you're going to get 2/3 of your normal receptions.
But would you rather be in an offense that likes to run the football as much as they do, that's only passing it 8 times in a playoff game, or would you rather play for an offense that throws the football down the field and now would have basically, like, you could have a rotation of guys running straight down the field every single play. Everyone gets a blow. No one's tired. It's fantastic. And the other thing is, too, this is how you take away from the San Francisco 49ers. You're not just taking away a playmaker. That means Jimmy Garoppolo only has Deebo Samuel, who we like. But Deebo Samuel, I mean, it seems like they're more creative in using him in the running game than they are throwing the football to him. And George Kittle's contract looming large on the horizon. How is Jimmy Garoppolo going to continue to develop if he doesn't have someone like Emmanuel Sanders? They could draft someone. The guy could work out. There could be a young player that rises through the ranks and actually turns into a good player. I know they have that Kendrick Bourne fellow. I love that his last name is Bourne. They like him a lot. But he's not Emmanuel Sanders. If Emmanuel Sanders is gone from San Francisco, that is a big, big-time pile of doo-doo for Jimmy Garoppolo to walk into next season.
So you rob from Peter and pay yourself.
Yes. Ooh. Fantastic.
Yeah, I could see that. I have no objections to going after. And that competitiveness, that's one of the reasons that Seattle ended up going as high as it did for Percy Harvin when they acquired him, because they knew that the 49ers were involved in that. If I had to prioritize free agent additions, though, and let's broaden it out from just Emmanuel Sanders, what position would you most like them to purchase in free agency? Because I want them to purchase pass rush. And the way I want them to purchase pass rush, the way that I think you get the most value, is trading for someone else's franchise-tagged player.
Okay. Options. Who are we thinking
about? Unique Ngakoue.
Okay.
Matthew Judon. I think that in this era, getting guys that don't, that can't come to an agreement, the Chiefs kind of showed it with Frank Clark, right?
Yes.
Like, the way you get value out of that is by saying, okay, we think we can do something with this guy that for whatever reason that team doesn't want to extend. Ngakoue meets that criteria for me. I like Ngakoue. I think that Ngakoue is going to be, and that's where I would put most of my resources, is getting a pass rusher, because I think that's going to be the hardest thing to find. Receiver's an interesting one, though. And Emmanuel Sanders is way better. When he was available at the trade deadline, I looked at it like, I don't think it's going to amount to much. I was wrong. He did. He was really good. And watching him, it's impossible not to say, like, oh, yeah, that guy could fit here and do some things.
The Jaguars pass rush without Yannick Ngakoue would definitely take a step back. You are hesitant to bring in receivers from other teams.
Yes.
I'm really hesitant to bring in pass rushers from other teams. It's about your scheme. It's about your system. And I am definitely gun-shy, and I shouldn't be. It's unfair to be gun-shy about going after a free agent pass rusher after the Seahawks basically took a flyer deal on the guy in Ziggy Ansah, who they're like, all right, we found him in the bargain bin. Let's see what happens. Let's see if this DVD in that giant box of DVDs that you can find at Walmart if you ever go there now, let's see if this actually turns into like an amusing Steven Seagal movie as opposed to, you know, like you're generally.
There are nothing but amusing Steven Seagal movies.
What's your favorite Steven Seagal movie?
Out for Justice.
Out for Justice. Okay. What's the one where he's the cook and Gary Busey's in it? Yeah.
Under Siege?
Under Siege. There we go. Yes. Thank you very much. Under
That's
Siege.
Right.
Yeah. Anyways.
Don't mess with my Seagal knowledge with his weird magic markered widow peak and strange martial arts
He's
background.
Great at karate. Just uses one hand, does everything in slow motion. But anyway.
It's not karate. It's Aikido.
If you bring in somebody from another team, there's a real chance that guy doesn't work out. And you're paying a lot more for someone like a Matthew Judon or a Yannick Ngakoue than you are for someone like Emmanuel Sanders.
You're totally right. Like, I'm advocating a strategy of, like, pile a bunch of chips in, because it's not only pay the dude, like, give up some draft picks for the right to do that.
He is Danny O'Neill. I am Paul Gallant. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle. Pete Rose is no Steven Seagal, but it's really interesting to see what he's doing. Is he is looking at a current really bad situation in sports, and he's trying to use it for his own advantage.
He's going to make it worse? He's really good at those things.
I'm looking forward to how this one plays out. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Over the past 30 years in which Pete Rose has been banned from baseball, he's not encountered a situation which he cannot make more uncomfortable.
Expand.
Whether he's signing autographs outside Cooperstown on Hall of Fame weekend.
That makes sense. I mean, it's the most natural place to sign autographs, Hall of Fame weekend.
The place he's not allowed to go to. Or it is petitioning Major League Baseball to overturn his banning of the game from the game in the wake of the Astros sign-stealing scandal, saying,
oh,
there, his lawyer in a brief said, you cannot have one set of rules for Pete Rose and another set for everybody else, and no players get punished for stealing signs, and the relatively light punishments, which, what, like a year for guys with PED violations, and yet now you have Pete Rose who can't get into the baseball, not allowed in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
In his defense, he has a point, doesn't he?
Yes.
I mean, it is ridiculous that no player got punished for the Astros sign-stealing incident when it seems that it was more about what the players were doing than it was about the actual manager.
Should you have done one game for every whack at the trash can? Like, if they had somebody who was able to count up all of the times that a trash can was banged at home, can't we just... That's how many game suspensions should be handed down?
Someone actually went through that trouble to do it.
I saw it.
I think it was, what, like a 1,080 or something like that, separate instances of trash can bangage.
Didn't you think that when you saw that, you're like, man, couldn't that have been put to better use?
Yes.
And that's really rich of me to say, someone who comes and talks on the air for sports 3 hours a day and calls that work. But at the same time, like, we're not going to get to Mars if people spend all that time counting up trash can strikes.
If you've watched the Netflix documentary, Don't Mess with Cats, on one hand, you would definitely think this is a waste of time. But after a while, you can definitely spend any amount of time spent on anything into being a noble pursuit of justice and the truth.
Now, to get back to Pete Rose, I think we both agree that the punishment at this point seems outsized.
Especially if gambling is becoming legal
across the country. It doesn't mean you can gamble on games, and I get it. But it's a very old school approach of like, hey, you can't, that's a line you just can't cross. I understand it. But this is really more about not liking Pete Rose than it is anything else. I think at this point, the game's bias or feeling is like, we just don't want Pete Rose involved. That he's a skeezy dude who is followed by not only the gambling accusations, but there have been even, well, a couple years ago, there were reports about his relationships with underage women back in the 1980s. Like all of these that I think that baseball is just like, look, we don't want anything to do with the guy, which is really, it's kind of strange. You don't usually see the leagues take a moral high ground with an older player who's one of their revered record holders.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it's funny because one of the guys whose record he broke for most career hits, Ty Cobb, wrote that he killed someone and he bragged about it. Like, that is an actual thing that happened.
They never took away OJ's Heisman either, so.
This is true. It's still there. Yet Reggie Bush's Heisman, nowhere to be found if you ever go visit Southern California.
Is it true that OJ's Heisman is still there?
It's still there. I went there back in 2011 for a USC-Syracuse game, and his Heisman was not there. His Heisman was there. Reggie Bush's Heisman was the missing Heisman.
I believe Reggie's got damaged when it went through an airport metal detector. Like, I think that's legitimately true. Like, this was before it was taken away from him. I think the Heisman had a couple fingers break off it because they put it through the metal detector at the airport, which I was like, why are you carrying that on, bro? Like, isn't that a little heavy for the...
The Heisman, it's really heavy.
It's pretty big. I mean, that looks like a two-handed trophy that you have to hold up. Here's my issue with it. Baseball having a moral high ground over guys that were iconic players that you're just supposed to forget makes no sense to me. We have seen it with Barry Bonds. We have seen it with Roger Clemens, who was very fishy after the Red Sox parted ways with him, all of a sudden becoming good again with the Toronto Blue Jays. I wonder what happened there in for the next 10 years. But you can't write the story of baseball without the best players. Barry Bonds is not a Hall of Famer. Get lost. He's the best player that I've ever watched live. He was so scary. People were walking the bases loaded with him, and it was actually the right move. That's my big thing with it. what he did, it's hard to believe that he never bet on his team to lose, which he claims he never did. He claims he only bet on the Reds to win. But I look at him and I'm like, he's one of the most important figures in the sports history. If baseball's Hall of Fame is a museum, how is he not there?
Even if he only bet on his team to win, that doesn't mean it was okay.
Right.
And the reason being because the manager has the ability to influence the outcome of games. And if he makes a decision with his bullpen usage based on the fact that he's got money riding on his team, like that sort
That's
of
fair.
Compromise, it's different. But at the same time, it's 30 years. It's 30 years that he's basically been a pariah. I think it's interesting that of all of the different rascals and people that have been around the game, that he's the one that apparently has the line drawn. I think baseball has a more favorable view of Barry Bonds and Clemens, even though those guys are still, they're not as big a pariah as Pete Rose is.
It's bizarre. But you can understand, too, with the things that you laid out, where he is going to Cooperstown and making things exceptionally awkward for everybody. If he maybe were to just go away and fade off into the sunset, then maybe they would put him in the Hall of Fame before he dies. I feel like that might be the move. That's how you punish him. You make him a Hall of Famer post-death.
There was a feature story, and I can't remember who wrote it. It has one of the better lines of any sports writing that I've ever read. And the story on Pete Rose ended with him being baseball's career leader in hits, yet never connected with another human being. Basically saying that he never was able to build good relationships with people.
People say about Bonds.
That his teammates didn't really like him. But there are people that do like Bonds. Like, there are, and he's, actually, Bonds is fairly beloved in San Francisco. Like, people still do really like Bonds.
I imagine the team does. I would wonder about his teammates.
Some of his teammates hated him. Jeff Kent.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think Jeff Kent would have relieved himself to extinguish Barry Bonds if he was a flame.
Right.
Like, I don't think that that was going to, they did not like each other. And there are other guys. There's also a story that Barry Bonds is the outfielder in it's early 90s, the Braves Pirates series that ends with Sid Bream running and sliding home, in which the story goes that Andy Van Slyke, who was the Pirates center fielder, waved Bonds in before the hit that happened there to say, hey, come closer in. And Bonds flipped him off and stayed where he was. And then the ball falls in front of Bonds. Bonds makes a throw home, and they're not able to get Sid Bream at the plate, who is abominably slow. So, yeah, I don't think he was the most beloved either. Should Pete Rose be allowed back into baseball? You can text in 710-710. It's powered by Coors Light. Coming up next, we've got Michael Bumpus. He's here. We're going to ask him if improving the defense requires addressing the offense. Can you accomplish the task that way? We'll talk to him next.